Greetings, and welcome to the Science Podcast for October 13th, 2006. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. Today, we'll look at a possible improvement to a key cancer treatment technique, the trials and tribulations of building the world's biggest thermonuclear fusion experiment, and the human brain's remarkable ability to recognize faces. All that, plus our usual roundup of other stories from Science and its daily news website, Science Now. So stick around. First up today, a possible improvement for a cancer treatment technique. For almost 10 years, physicians have been using treatments involving monoclonal antibodies to fight a variety of cancers, including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, some types of leukemia, breast cancer, and colorectal cancer. But finding the right fit between the antibody and the tumor's surface proteins hasn't been easy, and that has limited what might be done with this technique. Now, a new study by Andrea Schiedinger, Mary Philip, and five colleagues reported in the October 13th Science outlines a new strategy for identifying truly tumor-specific targets for monoclonal antibodies in human cancer cells. Ms. Schiedinger is on the line with us now to tell us a bit more about the study. Ms. Schiedinger, welcome to the Science Podcast.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Ms. Schiedinger, could you first just briefly remind our audience of what these monoclonal antibodies are and how they're used in cancer therapy?
Yeah. So the overall goal of cancer treatments is to destroy the cancer cell, but not the normal cells. And since cancer cells have many mutations, they express many mutant proteins which differ from normal proteins. So monoclonal antibodies have the ability to recognize and see these differences, and therefore can distinguish between malignant and normal. So monoclonal antibodies also can target non-dividing and dormant tumor cells. And this is in contrast to other conventional anti-cancer strategies, such as radiation or chemo, which do actually not distinguish and do not kill non-dividing cells. So that's the reason why there's so much interest in using monoclonal antibodies in cancer therapy.
So the advantage, as you're suggesting, is the kind of targeting that these antibodies allow. And
right.
That sounds like a powerful advantage. What is the problem then?
I would not say there is a problem with the technique itself using monoclonal antibodies to destroy the cancer cell. But you see, there are two factors which determine whether or not a monoclonal antibody will be effective. There's the properties of the antibody itself and the properties of the target antigen. And many innovative approaches have been used to modify the monoclonal antibodies themselves to make them more effective. But the challenging task still remains to identify and characterize new and better targets. So the ideal antigen should be a surface molecule whose extracellular domain is accessible to the antibody.
So the antibody can actually find it easily.
Right, right. And the second requirement is that it should be absolutely tumor-specific, which means that the antigen you only find on the tumor cell and not on normal tissue. So when you have shared antigens, which are found now on both the normal and the cancer cell, that can be problematic because they can lead to destruction of the normal tissue when you target them with the monoclonal antibody. But when you target tumor-specific antigens, you can potentially avoid these severe side effects. Now, when you look what tumor-specific antigens are, they have all been identified so far in mouse and humans to be mutant proteins, and they are inside the cell, so they cannot be seen by the monoclonal antibodies.
So your basic quest was to look for tumor-specific antigens that are sitting on the surface of the tumor so the antibody can find them.
Right.
And what did you look at as a possible way of resolving this?
Basically, we started out in our study with having a high-affinity, highly specific monoclonal antibody which recognized the surface protein, which was absolutely tumor-specific. And we found that this antigen was a wild-type protein, so it didn't have any mutations, but that the specificity was the result of a tumor-specific post-translational modification. So let me explain this a little bit. In eukaryotic cells, the majority of proteins are post-translationally modified, which means that after protein synthesis, proteins undergo additional changes such as phosphorylation or glycosylation and so on. So the extracellular domain of most surface proteins are glycosylated, which means that the proteins are decorated with various combinations of sugars. So now a hallmark of cancer, and that's known for decades, is that cancers have abnormalities in their glycosylation profile. So therefore, membrane proteins with such abnormal sugar structures are the logical targets for monoclonal antibodies. And in our study, we found that the novel combination of such an altered carbohydrate in association with a wild-type protein, so a non-mutant protein, and in our case it was OTS8, created an absolutely tumor-specific neoepitope, which then could be targeted by this monoclonal antibody.
And how did you work that out?
In normal cells, a specific enzyme called Cor1 galactosyl transferase is needed to elongate certain sugar chains on OTS8 and other proteins. And this enzyme transfers to the first sugar a second sugar and forms the disaccharide sugar Cor1. So it was previously shown that this enzyme requires, for its proper function, a chaperone. That's the protein which is absolutely required for the proper function of this enzyme. And if you do not have this chaperone, you do not have a functional transferase, and the second sugar cannot be attached to the first one. And in our tumor, this chaperone had a mutation.
So to put it another way, if I'm understanding correctly, the mutation wasn't in the surface protein, but it was in a helper protein that ordinarily would have helped with this complexing of the sugars around the protein, and that whole sort of system together formed the sequence that was recognized by the antibody.
Exactly. So basically, it's kind of a domino effect, right? You have a mutation in a chaperone, which then has an effect on a transferase, and the transferase then has its effect on many surface proteins. So, and this protein in the end, this wild-type protein with abnormal sugars, is tumor-specific. So what you have to keep in mind that when you talk about tumor specificity, that this kind of paradigm that you have a mutant gene, a mutant protein, and then that is creating the tumor antigen needs to be expanded to include antigens which are formed like the ones we described here.
Well, it sounds actually quite complicated,
right?
And I'm just curious, how applicable is this result going to be to other kinds of cancers?
Yeah, so the mutation in COSMIC, they have been found now in several human immune tumors of various origins. And since TN, this single sugar, this abundancy on cell surfaces, is widely found in certain cancer, we predict actually that this pathway leading to TN overexpression may be commonly targeted in cancer cells, and that you might find COSMIC mutations in other human cancers. And that means that there is already a host of potential glycopeptidic neoepitopes which are absolutely tumor-specific and that you can target with monoclonal antibodies.
Well, Ms. Schiedinger, congratulations to you and the team on this work, and good luck in the search for new targets.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Andrea Schiedinger is the lead author, with Mary Philip and five colleagues, of a new study identifying potential target antigens for monoclonal antibody therapy in cancers. The paper appears in the October 13th issue of Science. Just around the corner, the prospects for the world's biggest fusion experiment. Stay with us.
Did you know that the journal Science was founded by Thomas Edison in 1880? Even Edison's inventive mind could not have imagined its evolution into the world's leading journal of groundbreaking research and scientific news, in print and online. AAAS members can access seminars, podcasts, and all issues since 1880. Read today's stories and preview tomorrow's research, all at www.sciencemag.org. AAAS, advancing science into the future.
In the plasma physics community, there's an old joke that says, fusion is the power of the future, and always will be. The sometimes quixotic research quest for sustainable fusion power is about to find a long-awaited testbed in the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, or ITER, a $12 billion joint project involving the governments of China, the European Union, India, Japan, Korea, Russia, and the U.S. In a News Focus article in the October 13th issue of Science, Deputy News Editor Daniel Clary looks at the history and controversy of this enormous project. He's on the line with us from the UK to give us a taste. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
glad to be here.
So, Daniel, I gather that this project's purpose is basically to be a kind of a proof of concept for fusion power.
Yes, that's right. Earlier reactors, you know, their main goal was just to show that you could achieve fusion, that you could get hydrogen atoms to fuse together, but they didn't produce very much power. In fact, it takes a lot of energy to keep these reactions going, and none of them have yet produced more power than it actually took to run the reactor. So the aim now is to show that you can make much, much more power so that you would have excess that you could use to make electricity.
And I guess this project has been a long time in coming. If I'm not mistaken, we're entering the third decade since it was proposed.
That's true. It originally came from some physicists in the Soviet Union who wanted to make a big fusion project, didn't have the money, and they went to President Gorbachev at the time and, you know, suggested to him that he propose ITER as an international project. They also thought that it might help diffuse tensions between East and West. And so Gorbachev took this idea to a summit meeting with Ronald Reagan in 1985 and put it to him. And the Americans liked the idea. And 3 years later, you know, they started work, the two sides, along with European physicists, Japanese, and it went on from there.
But I guess it's had a kind of tangled history since then.
It has. By the, the late 90s, when they had completed the first design, the urgency had gone out of it. You know, oil prices were low. The partner countries didn't want to spend that much money to build this thing, so they asked the physicists to cut the price in half, and they had to go back to the drawing board and come up with a new design. And actually, at that time, the United States pulled out of the project entirely, but though they did rejoin again a few years later.
And one of the interesting points brought up in your article, if I'm understanding it correctly, is that these political delays, if we can call them that, have caused some problems with respect to the science outrunning the design.
That's true. Certainly when they had to cut the price in half, they had to cut a lot of things out that they wanted to do and reduce the aims of the project. And then they had to nail down the design in 2001. And since then, it's just been negotiations trying to get the partners to agree on a site and a price and so on. And in the 5 years since then, the physics has moved on. And so the researchers, you know, now they want to change the design. They want to do different things slightly than they did 5 years ago, which they hope will work better.
Well, what are some of those things? What are some of the technical challenges this project faces?
Well, it's a very complicated thing to do, make fusion on Earth. You know, it's done in the sun very easily, but what you have to do is create a lot of pressure in this gas and very, very high temperatures, 100 million degrees centigrade. And so you've got to be very careful, you know, how you line the interior of your reactor. You know, it's got to be a material that's very resistant to heat and bombardment of particles. You know, a lot of neutrons are coming out of this reaction. And also, it's a very hard thing to make behave, a plasma. You know, it wobbles and it shakes and, you know, it can impact on the surface, which can then degrade the reactor. And it's, you know, an incredibly complicated thing to try and get to work.
But even with those complications, though, I gather from reading your story that most of the people involved with this are pretty optimistic that it will achieve its primary goal, which is to generate significantly more power than it takes to run. What happens at that point?
Well, the aims that are set out for the project are to create 10 times more power than they have to put in to make the experiment run. And people are fairly confident that they can do that. But one of the problems with fusion reactors at the moment is they can only do it for a very short period. You know, the design of the reactor, how they confine the plasma, it's done in pulses. So they can only at most get it working for a few minutes. So a big challenge is to try and coax it to run for a longer time. You know, they think if they can get it running for half an hour, then that's as good as, you know, a continuous process, and that, you know, when they go on to the reactor after that, they should be able to get the thing that will run for years and just keep producing power.
But that first half hour is going to cost $12 billion, eh?
That's right. It's a very complicated machine. It's got, you know, the biggest superconducting electromagnets that have ever been built, and you know, huge vacuum vessels that have to be filled with liquid helium and things like that. It's a big machine. It's the next most expensive experiment after the International Space Station.
Well, Daniel, thanks for giving us a look at where this very big project is going.
It was a pleasure.
Daniel Cleary's news focus on the ITER project appears in the October 13th issue of Science. You can find it online at our website at science.sciencemag.org. Coming up in a moment, the brain's amazing system for processing faces.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS, advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
Each year, Science Magazine and the international biotech firm Eppendorf jointly sponsor a neurobiology essay contest for young scientists. The prize-winning essay for 2006, which appeared in the October 6 issue of Science, is by Doris Chow, who currently works at the Institute for Brain Research and Center for Advanced Imaging at Germany's University of Bremen. Over the past 10 years, as a grad student, postdoc, and independent researcher, she has used functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, and other techniques to explore how the brain perceives the three-dimensional world. Her prize-winning essay on the brain's system for recognizing faces appears in the October 6th issue of Science, and we're delighted to have her on the line now to talk about her work. Dr. Chow, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, your essay in Science, as I mentioned, focuses on the neurobiology of face recognition, and this really does seem to be a pretty remarkable human ability. I've heard, for example, that even newborn infants tend to focus on faces and will look at a face longer than they'll look at other objects. Is there a part of the human brain that is specifically wired, if you will, for face recognition?
Yes, there seems to be. So people can suffer strokes that selectively destroy their ability to recognize faces while preserving their ability to recognize all other objects. And this is called prosopagnosia, and it strongly suggests that there is a special region in the brain for face processing. And about 10 years ago, Nancy Kanwisher, using fMRI in humans, found an area in the brain that lights up much more strongly to faces than to other objects. And these two findings together suggest that there is specialized machinery in the brain for processing faces.
And you mentioned fMRI. Just before we go on, you know, since some of your work dealt with that technique as well, maybe you could just quickly tell us how that works.
Yeah, fMRI detects changes in magnetization in the brain due to blood flow, and it's a relatively coarse measure of neural activity. So, as you know, the brain is made of neurons, and fMRI measures activity in about cubic millimeters of cortex, which contain hundreds of thousands of neurons. But the remarkable power of fMRI comes from the fact that it lets you see the entire brain at once.
So, in other words, you can see by the blood that's flowing to these various regions what regions of the brain are important in a certain
exactly.
function.
Mm-hmm.
Now, getting back to face recognition, you got interested in this area during your grad study, I believe, at Harvard Medical School in the late 1990s. What were the specific problems you were looking at there, and how did you go about studying them?
Well, I started my PhD recording from primary visual cortex, which is the first area in the brain that gets inputs from the eyes. So I thought that would be a sensible place to start studying vision. And I was interested in questions relating to 3D spatial vision and to form perception. But it quickly became clear that the cells in primary visual cortex are coding a piecemeal version of the world. So they're just coding the edges and the local colors and motion, and they're not putting it together yet into, you know, these gestalt forms. And that's how I got interested in fMRI, because I wanted to study these higher-level forms, and there's so much cortex beyond primary visual cortex that's involved in vision, and I didn't know where to go. So that's why I adapted the technique of fMRI for monkeys, so I could find in the monkey brain, you know, the regions, for example, that are specialized for face processing, and then I could study them in detail with single-cell recording.
And that sort of leads into the next step, which is you started looking at these things on a single neuron level, correct?
Right, yeah.
And you published a really interesting paper earlier this year, I think, in Science, where you looked at this. And I was looking at some of the graphs. It's amazing how responsive the neurons in these face-sensitive regions are to facial stimuli.
Yeah, the very first day that we put our electrode in this region, you know, that we found with fMRI that lit up the faces, it was amazing. Like, almost all the cells were face selective, and many of the cells responded 20 times as strongly to faces as to other objects.
So, in other words, when you were probing these individual neurons and you showed the subject a face, the response of those neurons was like 20-fold higher?
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of gets to the question of what makes a face. I guess the fact that it's a round object is only part of the story. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So when we looked at the responses of these cells to, you know, 96 different faces and other objects, it was very interesting. They all responded very strongly to the faces, but they also, many of them, showed a weak response to a few specific non-face objects. And when we looked at these non-face objects, it turned out they were all round, so it was clocks and oranges and apples. And this is interesting for two reasons. First, the fact that the cells are picking up this round shape means that they're coding faces in terms of shape and not in terms of, for example, emotional arousal or just biological form or something more vague like that. And secondly, it's interesting because the responses to these round objects was much weaker than that to a fully intact face, which means that they are picking up not just the roundness, but some other features of a face as well.
And I think you did some additional work, or you're doing some additional work, to try to quantify or figure out what pieces these areas are putting together to kind of make up a face. Is that right?
Yeah, so we're using cartoon faces in which we're systematically varying the geometry of the cartoon face. For example, we can change the size of the irises or the distance between the eyes or the overall shape of the face and so on. And we can generate a huge cartoon face space in this way. And I've actually shown rapid sequence of different cartoon faces to a large set of different face cells. And what I found when I looked at the responses of these cells is that many of them are tuned to a subset of these cartoon feature dimensions. So they'll show a systematic increase in activity as you increase the size of the eyes, or as you change the shape of the face, you know, from a Bert-shaped face to an Ernie-shaped face, and so on. And so each cell is acting like a set of face-specific rulers that are measuring these different geometric parameters of a face.
And so you're able to pick out from that what you called a large cartoon space the sort of most important elements that the brain is using to process these data.
Yeah, and what's really exciting about this work is that, you know, when we see a face, we instantly recognize who it is, but it's really hard to put into words exactly, you know, why that looks like, you know, your mother. And when we look at these individual cells, we can actually take apart this problem and really understand it in nuts and bolts.
Well, Dr. Chow, congratulations on a fascinating essay and on some remarkable work. And thanks a lot for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you.
Doris Chow of the Institute for Brain Research and Center for Advanced Imaging at the University of Bremen is the 2006 winner of the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. You can read her prize-winning essay, as well as those of the runners-up, at www.eppendorfscienceprize.org. Finally today, our usual roundup of some interesting stories from Science's free daily news site, Science Now. Eric Stockstead, Science Now's managing editor, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS to talk about what's what.
Eric, thanks for joining us in the studio today.
Pleasure to be here.
I understand you're going to talk to us about a few of the pieces on Science Now, and the first one I hear is about flowers.
That's right. It's about flower evolution. And the question is, how did the shapes of flowers evolve? Two basic kinds. The first type of flower shape to evolve was radial symmetry. That's like a lily has. But several times in the history of flowers, bilateral symmetry evolved. So the question is, how did that happen and why?
Well, what kind of examples are the bilateral flowers?
Think of an orchid there. That's one where you can imagine mirror symmetry on it. So to figure this out, the researchers went to the mountains of southeastern Spain where there's a strange kind of plant, a Mediterranean herb that grows there. And unlike most plants, this one has both radial symmetric and bilaterally symmetric flowers on the same plant. So this let them test the idea that pollinators might be driving the evolution of plants. So what they did was they checked out what insects were pollinating the plant. And once they'd done that, they sat and they watched plants and checked out who was visiting the flowers. Now, the most common visitor was a pollinating beetle. Then what they did was they checked what kind of flowers it liked. And it turns out it preferred to land on the bilaterally symmetrical flowers. And what's neat about that was they found out that those flowers had more seeds. So you can imagine that over the course of generations, you might evolve a plant that has only bilaterally symmetric flowers on it.
Does this mean my favorite flower, the lily, is going to be abandoned?
I don't think so. We've got lots of humans taking care of those.
Great. So what do you have next?
We did a story about the Oracle at Delphi. She was a prophet who would fall into a trance and give advice to people in ancient Greece.
Kind of like the Ann Landers of her time?
Well, imagine Ann Landers on drugs, yeah.
Ah.
It was long dismissed as a myth, but not too long ago, geologists realized that the faults under the temple might have released gases, and those gases might account for the trance. The first idea was that it was a gas called ethylene that was coming out.
And what is ethylene?
Well, that stimulates the central nervous system, and it can produce euphoria. So it's a logical idea.
Okay.
What happened now is another group went, and they brought sensors to the temple, but they couldn't detect any ethylene. So what they think is it was other gases, probably carbon dioxide and methane, that might have been causing oxygen deprivation in the inside the temple, and that was what caused the
euphoria.
Yeah, exactly.
So who's right? Which gas is causing the euphoria?
I think they probably have to go back and do some more measurements. So this one, I would say, stay tuned.
Okay. And finally, Eric, you have a piece about the salmon we eat?
Most of the salmon we eat comes from salmon farms. And these farms have been criticized for a number of different kinds of environmental impacts. One of those is that they can harm wild salmon by passing on sea lice.
Sea lice? What are those?
Well, those are small crustaceans. And they live out in the open ocean, and they usually attach to adult salmon and feed on the slime and skin and suck their blood. They can also infest salmon farms. And the problem here is that salmon farms often are located where young wild salmon, after they spawn, where they swim back to the ocean. So recently people discovered that those young wild salmon are picking up sea lice from the salmon farms. The question, though, is how bad is this for the young salmon? And people didn't really have an idea what the mortality was. So a group went out and they counted the lice on 14,000 salmon.
Wow, that had to be a long, arduous task.
A lot of graduate students. So they tossed them back in. And then what they did was when they knew how many lice were living on the wild salmon, they could go in and create a model and figure out how many salmon, wild salmon, might be killed by these lice that are coming from the salmon farms.
So how many fish are affected?
Well, depending on various factors, it could be anywhere between 9% or 95% of fish migrating out could be killed by the lice.
Wow. Are any of these infected salmon getting into the actual food that we eat?
Good question. The lice live on the outside of the salmon. So once they're harvested from the farms or caught by fishermen, the lice either fall off or they're scraped off. So you don't have to worry about accidentally eating a sea louse. But what the study really shows is that the salmon farms are having an impact on wild salmon. And so other experts are calling for better management of the farms to reduce the sea lice problem.
Eric, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Eric Stockstedt is the managing editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the October 13th, 2006 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science. Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the podcast, and our producer is Barnaby Bristol. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science. On behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.